You're listening to The Cat Business Show, and I'm Kat. In today's show, I catch up with Steph Aquarone, the recently appointed Vice Chair of North Norfolk Liberal Democrat Party, who in 2014 was named by the Daily Mirror as one of the top 20 most influential media figures under 30. And hello, Steph, and welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
That's absolutely fine. Now, you've got quite an illustrious sort of background there, haven't you, with business? And, of course, you're now into politics. So it makes probably good sense to start with, what attracted you into the political arena?
Well, I've always been interested in making things happen. And I think when I was at university reading politics, because I thought that would be interesting, turns out it wasn't actually that interesting. I think I realised that being interested in making things happen and liberal politics, the likes of which the Liberal Democrats have been involved with, were kind of one and the same thing. They were quite closely connected. So that rather than just sort of spending time talking about ideas, you'd actually go out and do things that embody those ideas and those values. And I was really inspired by the idea of what has been called community politics for a long time, which is that if you think something, go out and show that it's a better way of doing things.
Yeah.
And I'd long been interested in politics, but I was also aware that lots of politicians had never done anything else, so I wanted to try and do something else first. Set off with no sort of time scale about when I might get involved with politics, but when the timing was right, which was about this time last year, I decided that was when I would change career and go and give it a go.
Wow. So the whole sort of background that you had there with, you know, obviously going at Warwick University, you were out, weren't you, reading politics?
That's it.
Has obviously given you a nice sort of coloured background, but surely that must be quite different to actually doing the job on the ground.
Yeah, it's totally different, although when you study politics, you study power, and power is a pretty big part of practical politics. Of course, what it doesn't teach you is about knocking on doors and delivering leaflets and dealing with local politics issues, some of which are really big, some of which are potholes. Nobody's sort of teaching that sort of stuff. But the study of power and how and why people want it and what they do with it, I suppose, was quite relevant and quite accurate. And I can see even in the machinations of Norfolk County Council how some of those texts that we read are exactly relevant and very much being borne out by the way that politicians do their business. But no, from a practical point of view, it's kind of separated from the reality in the way that most subjects, I think, probably are. I found actually politics more relevant to business than practicing politics, and I've probably found doing business more useful for doing politics than reading politics was. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, of course, in business, you have got power games as well, haven't you?
Yeah.
I mean, in actual fact, life is full of power games, isn't it? I find that quite interesting about the idea that politics is about power. And in some respects, it is, isn't it? But on the other hand, surely it's also about the voice of the people and giving power to the people, maybe.
Well, I think that's my version of the politics of power, which is that my political credo is to take power away from people and institutions that have inherited it or obtained it other than properly. A lot of institutions have always had power. That's why they carry on existing and they become very self-serving, which is why I've never been able to kind of subscribe to the socialist cause. I just don't trust big institutions enough of any variety. But similarly, you know, inheritance of property and wealth means that it's very difficult for people really to live life to the full and live out their opportunities when so much of what they have to choose from is controlled by people that have inherited the power to influence people's lives. So for me, it's very much about power to people, but not doing things to them or for them, helping them to do things that they've decided that are right for them. That's my particular brand. And that's pretty typical of anyone who's a liberal, I guess. In business, of course, there is a lot of politics. I suppose the reason I find business okay to deal with is I've always felt that it's much cleaner and simpler to see where the real motives are.
Right.
So I read the Financial Times because, like every newspaper on the planet, it's biased.
Yeah.
But it's pro-business. And it's pretty easy to see through a pro-business bias. Business just wants to make money for shareholders as the fundamental thing. And if that requires it to do other things as well as just pursue profit, then it will do that in a very rational and quite predictable way. That causes all sorts of problems, but it's sort of a cleaner type of power politics to get your head around than what happens when people do politics for themselves. And they might still think that it's a route to money. I've certainly not found that politics is a particularly great route to making
not
money.
Yet.
But well, it's sort of, if you're really successful, you have the salary of a middle manager for the tenure of a professional footballer. Yeah. So it's never very good in the best case scenario. But maybe that's part of the problem why we have so many issues. But anyway, that's what I would say about politics in business. Mm. What's been much more relevant to me, I suppose, is business necessarily requires you to learn how to negotiate with people, yeah. how to deal with them. The sorts of businesses that I was running and that I founded were in many cases either in the business of communications mm-hmm. or required, before they could sell a product, to sell an idea and to persuade people of something and persuade people of a better way of doing things. And not all business is progressive in that way, but the businesses that I was involved with were all trying to change people's thinking or motivation as well as trying to sell them something.
Yeah, which is politics with a small p, isn't it?
Absolutely.
But two sides of the same coin, really, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, totally. We all do politics. You know, we all exercise power, even if it's only over our lives and nobody else's.
Absolutely.
It's still, you know, it's still very much about personal power as well.
Yeah. And how much do you think that business influences the direction of the country? Because it's quite an interesting position we're in at the moment, isn't it? And I think from the let's say the little man's point of view on the street, you often feel that actually it's not, the balance of power in Parliament is really actually driven by the big corporates and the conglomerates behind the scenes. I mean, that might be a very cynical view that I myself hold.
Yeah.
But do you agree with that? Do you think actually, no, it is about the people?
I mean, businesses seek to influence policy to their own advantage, of course. I think if you want a good example of when that can go badly wrong, it's looking at things like the NRA in the United States or the climate change lobbyists in the United States. They don't believe that climate change isn't man-made. They just want to purport that it isn't in order to further their business interests. And the influence they have over politics is profound because they influence directly the money that candidates need to get elected.
Yeah.
In this country, I don't believe we have a problem of funding political parties from business.
Mm.
I think it's inevitable that the party that tends to like to see itself in power has a lot of business sponsorship.
Yeah.
I don't think we've got anything like the problem that America has with that directly influencing the decisions that are made in Parliament. I think if they're serving anybody other than the people, they're serving the party and the politicians in the party.
Yeah.
We do have a problem with people who've been in government and in civil service going into big business, I think. I don't think that's healthy. I think that gives those businesses unfair insight into government thinking and strategy.
Yeah.
But I think the real problem that people tune into and kind of point at various things, whether it's immigration or Europe or business, when they feel that problem pinching them, is a problem of individual power and the fact that it's been taken away by all sorts of vested interests. It's not as simple as saying, well, big business controls what government does.
Mm-hmm.
It's the case that many of us have become so far removed from the decisions that affect our day-to-day lives that we recognise it and we don't quite often know where to point the finger.
Yeah.
There's no single actor, you know, clever or powerful enough to be saying, hey, we've got all the power, let's use it to our advantage. It's all sorts of things. And removing business and politics is not the solution to doing that. You've got to be doing something constructive, not reductive, I think, to change that.
And that's really interesting because actually, you know, you mentioned there about, you know, the people pointing the finger or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's because they feel powerless as well, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's understandable. It's totally understandable.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pro-business. I think it's a good way of making society work and of evolving things.
Sure.
I don't think it's the answer to human progress, nor do I think it's in itself a good thing. I think it depends on the types of businesses you have.
Yeah.
And I'm as suspicious, I guess one of the things that a lot of liberals share is a view that there is never the right answer for one thing forever.
No.
So something which has been brilliantly looked after by the state for tens of years, like the NHS, is actually, if we're honest, in a dire straits mess.
Of course.
That's not because the state wasn't the right body to look at it, and now the market is instead. It's because we've assumed that the state is the only way to do it, and it's become a rule unto itself.
Yeah.
So trying to reform the NHS, even if you, you know, doing it for all the right reasons, becomes almost impossible because that's been the answer. It's the default answer for too long and no one's dared touch it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying my main policy platform is to go and reform the NHS. It's not just an example. But saying that, oh, well, business is the right way of solving such and such an issue, the state is the only one that can solve another type of issue, is just, both of those are equally stupid things to say, in my opinion.
Sure.
I think you have to constantly challenge and question whether the right solution is in place. And the most legitimate solution, even though it's not always feasible, is for a community of people who are affected by the outcome of the decisions that are made, being the ones that are having power over them.
Yeah.
Communities are the most democratically legitimate way of allowing decisions to be made and power to be exercised. But, of course, you know, you can't expect the community to do everything.
No.
We wouldn't have an advanced, complex society if we expected every village to look after every aspect of its civic duties. But there is an imbalance, generally, against the role of communities.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I think needs to change.
Hmm, that's really interesting. I'm just thinking about, you know, you mentioned there about the NHS being one of the main issues that the country's facing, clearly, obviously, is. The other one, of course, is Brexit.
Yeah.
And where the country's going to be heading in a different direction and what that's going to look like. We, at the moment, we're really not quite sure.
Yeah.
What else, well, perhaps that's all that's facing businesses, but what else do you think is particularly challenging for businesses at the moment?
So I think this is sort of... what's challenging for business at the moment? I mean, the stock response from businesses is always uncertainty is the biggest challenge.
Of course.
Well, that's because businesses would prefer a world of certainty, because that means they could be certain about how they're going to extract profits from a particular scenario. So I don't think the lack of certainty is ever something that should be remedied or should be the focus of politicians' attitude to business. I think if I was running a business right now, which I'm not, I'm in the process of starting a couple of things off, but if I was actually running a business right now, I think the challenges would be the unpredictable nature of technology adoption.
Yeah.
So it's seen as one of the big sort of threats to big business is the innovator coming along and you know, stealing their lunch. In fact, that sort of belief that there'll be an Uber of everything at some point is totally ridiculous, because it completely fails to understand the sheer weight of failure in startup communities. You know, startups are not an efficient way of making new things happen. They're extremely inefficient on every ground, capital, talent, human, whatever. It's just like the lottery is not an efficient way of getting rich.
Yes.
And so I think for a lot of businesses, it's not so much the startup versus old-fashioned business. It's the fact that a lot of the changes in sectors, particularly ones that haven't really changed much since the web came along, is down to the timing of when there's mass market adoption of a particular thing.
Yeah.
You know, we wouldn't have had the massive change in home entertainment consumption unless we'd already had, for lots of reasons, the massive uptake in people paying for high-speed internet to be delivered to their homes.
Sure.
We wouldn't have had the smartphone without, you know, what the smartphone really was the coincidental invention of better battery life, touchscreens and data connectivity. Yeah. It's just the guy in the turtleneck shirt happened to be the one who brought it out at the time. Yeah, so that sort of feels predictable in hindsight, but when you're up against it in business, I think it's almost impossible to think of the 100 new things that you read about that come over the horizon every few days, it feels like, you know, which one of those a year is going to actually be adopted in the mainstream and therefore have an impact on your business in the future.
Sure.
I think that is almost certainly the number one question facing all businesses of any type, because all businesses are vulnerable to the disruption of the way that customers buy things.
Yeah, that's true. It's almost like a moving target, isn't it? The external environment for a business is always moving, and so therefore it's always about analysing it and making sure that you're up against, you know, on top of things, but also predicting, aren't you?
Yeah, but a lot of businesses have not built up the expertise to take full advantage of the stuff they can analyse and measure.
Yeah.
So whilst it might seem random, there is actually a pattern or an evolutionary system behind the way that society adopts technology and changes that then causes the change in business. So the businesses that are really able to not forecast what's going to happen, but have a better sense of what the likely scenarios are going to be, are the ones that can really extract kind of meta-analysis of the data they have.
Yeah.
And people talk about big data without really understanding what it means, but if you have so much information coming into your organisation that it's impossible for a team of humans to really interrogate that data without getting no further down than an inch deep, mile wide is the kind of description of the problem. then you can use pretty sophisticated artificial intelligence to analyse where in that data you might find some patterns, and what those patterns, therefore, when you do go and inspect them manually, might tell you about the future.
Yeah.
The businesses that can do that are the ones that are able better to understand what's coming over the horizon. I think the businesses that are sitting there sort of rubbing their eyes are the ones that haven't worked out how to do that. So everything seems random and unpredictable. And you know, a new thing could be invented without them having any foresight of it at all. Well, there is a way of getting foresight, but it's about tuning into the signals that are now available that weren't before.
Exactly. And it's looking at trends, isn't it? And it's looking at barriers to entry into markets, and it's looking at the latest technology, I should say. I mean, I think the interesting thing is, of course, we are in this digital age now, and you mentioned there about artificial intelligence, and I was going to bring that up as a particular thing that has immense opportunities for business, but also has immense issues that could potentially be problematic for society as a whole.
Yes.
I mean, only recently, I think it was last week, I read about something in Facebook and their little bots talking to each other and actually starting to create their own language, you know, into the Cybernine system if we're not careful.
I mean, this is not new. So the thing about technology adoption is it rarely ever gets into cyborg Blade Runner territory.
Yet,
except it still hasn't. We've had 100 years now of hyperbolic technology innovation that has led to great panic amongst people. And for something to become mainstream, it has to be acceptable and adopted by the majority of people.
Yeah.
So, will a robot that is hell-bent on destroying the universe be possible to be created? Yeah, of course, it's always been possible to be created. Will it become a mainstream part of the world that we have to worry about? Well, only if we all agree to it. Yes. So, this is where stuff that people don't understand, like data privacy, is dangerous. Mm-hmm. But stuff people do understand, like robots taking over the world, is not actually as dangerous as it sounds. And throughout the last 60 years, we've had AI, people call it AI summers and AI winters. But AI summers are where there's some breakthrough which gets everyone extremely excited. And unfortunately, rather than the academic community that's persisted in the background to develop that particular technology being able to make several cascading leaps in a very short space of time, everyone gets distracted saying, what about cyborgs? Or, the sort of crazy topics that have nothing to do with really the next step that's just been opened up. And we're in the middle of an AI summer at the moment because of the AlphaGo software that was developed and last year beat a professional Go player. This is significant because, unlike chess, where a computer can actually map out every possible permutation of the game, the number of permutations of the game Go are more than the number of atoms in the observable universe. So it's impossible for a computer to win by working out the most likely successful moves.
Right.
It has to learn how to play.
How to do it.
And that's a big thing. But is a machine playing one of the simplest to play board games in the world a threat to humanity? No, it's not at all.
No.
Politicians are a bigger threat to humanity
right
now.
That's probably very true.
With weapons especially.
Yes, absolutely. And which is probably the environment we're currently sitting in, isn't
it? Right now, as we record this, it definitely is. Yeah. If anyone's listening, then no, it didn't happen.
No, it didn't happen. We're all here. We're all fine. Thank goodness. Yeah, so that's really interesting about technology and being able to take businesses forward. And yes, of course, there's danger with artificial intelligence, but of course, there's great opportunities as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that the businesses that can adapt and to taking on technology like that will in fact be the ones that thrive?
Absolutely. Yes. These technologies are commercially relevant because they give businesses advantages. Advantages to be able to better predict what's going to happen, better understand what their customers are doing, at a very useful level, better understand what people want and how to serve their needs. So the businesses that can adapt to this sort of stuff are the ones that are more likely to succeed.
Yes.
I think the challenge that most businesses that are bigger than 50 people have is just organisational inertia and the fact that in large organisations, a large number of people are employed who are adding no value.
Yes.
And that's just because of the way that businesses evolve. Mm. They have problems. They fix those problems by hiring people in. And those people who are hired in fix the problem, and then they look for ways in which they can keep themselves in a job.
Yeah.
Culturally speaking, I don't mean individually, but they are. That's what they're doing once they've solved the problem. They don't want to leave again. They want to make sure they've got a role. Mm. And that leads to huge inefficiency. Mm. And even if not inefficiency, huge scale. So turning around a business and making it think in real time about what it's hearing through listening to the comments of its customers online you know, when it previously would only really think about things once a year and respond to some market research, is a very, very difficult task.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money being made by consultants in that area at the moment. The answer is not, of course, to behave like a startup, because that then says, of all of the great successes that this multi-million pound business with thousands of happy customers and history of profit margins has done, let's try and deliberately undermine that by randomly speculating on not enough things to be able to guarantee success. So that's the problem, is a lot of businesses are trying to behave like startups. And even sort of away from the caricature of, you know, AstroTurf and people in jeans and T-shirts, they're still thinking, oh, well, you know, we should do things in an agile way. What does that actually mean?
Yeah.
You know, that's a method invented by coders to ship code efficiently. It doesn't mean anything in business unless you actually say what do you mean by it. So they're adopting a lot of the behaviours, but the fundamental behaviour of the startup is one where everyone kind of expects them to fail, and only a very small handful don't, and then an even smaller handful actually go on and succeed in the long term.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, when you look at the, you know, like we were talking about artificial intelligence there, and then, you know, data and technology, great opportunities. But how does it balance with that, you know, political environment, which you're, you know, obviously you're coming from as well, where the consequence of that, where business is succeeding using all this technology, the consequence could be that, of course, you know, efficiencies equals loss of jobs.
Yeah.
How do you, in your own mind, balance business versus politics when you're representing the people?
Well, I don't think that politicians can stand in the way of progress. They should be driving progress.
Yep.
And to me, trying to protect jobs by halting technical innovation is halting progress.
Yep.
And I do not, it's one of the reasons I'm not in the part of the political spectrum that some of my other values might sympathise with, because I do not believe in halting human progress for the sake of jobs.
Mm.
It's a shaming indictment on society that the people who are displaced by technology can't go and do something else of equal value in a different place.
Yes.
But they're stuck because they've only had one career path, one training experience, and none of the opportunity to be able to actually apply themselves in an equally valuable way, but doing something different. Yeah, that's the result of serious political failure.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think, to answer your question about context, at its best, Parliament is there, and you know, I'm not in favour of the upper house, but as a revisionist chamber, is there to be, I think, to ask difficult questions of change. It's inevitable that legislation will always be playing catch up.
Yeah.
So part of the politician's job, I think, is to hold a mirror up to society and say, this is the direction we're going in.
Yeah.
They won't be able to act fast enough to stop it, realistically. And nor is it right for them to be clinging on to certain things like employment at all costs to try and prevent it from damaging people's lives. They should be feeding back to people where things are going and shaping the legislative agenda that might catch up after a few years' time.
Mm.
But protectionism and trying to keep things the way they are is something which actually both the left and the right have long favoured for different reasons, and I'm not for it. I can't stand for it. We won't get anywhere. You know, we've got a long way to go before, as a society, we make the next really big leap.
Yeah.
I don't think that going to Mars at the moment is the way to do that.
Not quite.
But someone's trying it. But I think that we've got a long way to go. But we need to be putting our best foot forward.
Yeah. Excellent. I was just thinking there about the fact that we've had this general election this year, which came out of the blue, took everybody by surprise, and of course Lib Dems had to react to that as much as the other parties. Many years ago I was actually involved in a campaign for the general election for the Liberal Democrats.
Right, and were you really in Norfolk?
No, this was the national campaign in terms of advertising and marketing, which of course is my background. And it was about actually the creation, or with the London agency, of outdoor advertising posters.
Which election was this?
This was 1992.
Was it right? Okay.
And it was a...
Paddy Ashdown's election.
It would have been that one indeed. Yeah. Yes, it would.
Got the asterisk because there were so few votes, it was within the statistical realm of error.
Was it?
Not that was down to your work.
I was going to say, of course, the campaign was hugely successful. However, the result of the Liberal Democrats wasn't quite as good.
No, it was
terribly bad. But, I mean, the thing that strikes me, of course, is that going back, that's quite a few years ago, 20 odd years ago. So that was a very different fought campaign to the landscape it would have been this year, which was very much fought in terms of, you know, on the street with the people, using digital marketing, social media. How do you feel things have changed in the approach to that kind of activity?
Well, I think politicians, especially in the Liberal Democrat Party, have mistaken message and medium. So they've looked at social media and they said, oh, we need to be doing things on social media, but they're doing the same things they were doing before, just over some sort of new pipes, basically. And instead, what's happened is only slightly more complicated. It's that social media has arrived and it's allowed people to say it how it is, to share their opinions in a much more authentic and accessible way than before. And so one of the things that's caused is a greater appetite for truth and authenticity. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the problem. That's the point at which a lot of politicians become unstuck, because they've masqueraded for years on the opposite of truth and authenticity.
You may say that, but I couldn't possibly comment,
Steph.
Well,
I think politicians are quite terrible. I'm trying to avoid becoming one of them. Not doing very well so far. So the way that the campaigns ought to be fought now is not based upon, great, here are some new ways we can pump crap at people, but here is a way in which we can actually try and say it as it is, be really candid and authentic and truthful, which involves changing your mind about things, and use some of these more direct means to get access to people that want to hear that sort of thing. And the problem is that's not happening.
Yeah.
So it's not the reason the Labour Party did better than expected in the general election. I don't think a lot of that was actually based at all on the compelling and attractive parts of the policy package people tuned into. I think it was all sorts of factors anyway. It's not happening across the board. And the way that political parties should be campaigning is in the same way that successful brands have been communicating over the past 10 years in response to some of those changes, which is they have been setting out their stalls by describing, first of all, their purpose, why they exist, and then describing or explaining their values to explain how they go about doing that. And that's how big successful brands have taken advantage of this change in communications. And politicians, especially liberals, have been very bad in the past at explaining why they're doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. It does sort of look ridiculous from the outside. Why would you ever get involved in a political movement that, you know, had at the moment no chance of success at all, statistically, and whose closest experience of power resulted in the largest collapse in their vote share for a generation? It's not an obvious choice.
No.
But there is something about the purpose and the fundamental values of the Liberal Democrats that attracted me. The communications challenge is having the gall to actually stand up and explain, you know, why you're standing for that particular set of values.
Yes.
And that also involves some uncomfortable truths about not treating people like idiots.
Yeah.
Expecting that they will be able to understand values if you can craft the communication in a straightforward and accessible way. They'll be able to relate to you when you explain why your values mean that you think this is the right way to do something. But that's not yet sort of filtered into the way that political communications or political messaging is carried out, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, really? Because actually, you make the point there about brands being able to communicate their values, empowering the people to decide whether or not they want to buy that brand.
On a good day,
On a good day, absolutely. And so really, all politics is really about, if they want to succeed, is making sure that the messages are the right messages, talking to the right people in the right way, and switching them on, isn't it?
Yes, so, I mean, that's what the success of New Labour taught us. I think there's a danger that becomes quite a tautology, which is that the way to get elected is just to fight a really great campaign and do better than your opponents. And of course that's also true. I think that the fundamental shift is necessary to sort of reassert that, which is that I think people care more now about the person and the motive than they do anything else.
Yeah, sure.
That's actually a really healthy thing. It's much healthier for people to be cynical and questioning of their parliamentary candidates than it is for them to be looking at policies and thinking, well, which one is going to be most economically rational for me?
Yes.
That is the hope, I think, of the Conservative movement, is that people see the stuff and in the main they've managed to craft something which is going to benefit the most number of people. That's how they've managed to encroach upon Labour's traditional territory, is just through exploiting self-centeredness. But that's not the way that people actually prefer to behave. People don't behave economically rationally all the time. And when it comes to politics, if you can engage people in a conversation that is about values and it's about society, it's not just about income tax and how much they've got in their pockets, then they would prefer to have that conversation, yes. I think. And I don't think that's necessarily, therefore, then easy to translate into electoral success. I think the whole pound in the pocket is what matters idea is still the largest influence on people's ballot behaviour. But I think in terms of the types of conversations people want, you know, they don't want to talk to brands about how much they cost, they want to talk to them about what it's going to be like to be part of their world.
Absolutely.
I think the same for a visionary political movement.
Absolutely. Steph, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It has been really, really great, and I wish you all the success.
Thank you very much.
In your political career and, of course, your business career
thank
as well.
Thank you very much indeed.
All right. Thank you.
See you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Cat Business Show. For more information about me, my business school, and to listen to past shows, please visit cat.uk.com. Bye for now.